As a small business owner, Danny Paris was the quintessential success story. He'd started with $5,000, opened up an appliance store, and within a few years, he was a millionaire. It was the early 80s in a small town in Michigan, and fueled by his own success, Danny expanded his enterprise, opening new stores and filling them with inventory that he'd bought with the help of big loans. Then the automotive industry collapsed around him. Unemployment in his town went up to 38%, and Danny found himself staring at showrooms full of appliances that were collecting dust.
The prime rate was 12%. Unemployment was staggering across the country, and I ended up with $1.3 million in inventory. I was really out on a limb.
One day, Danny got word that within 24 hours, his creditors would be showing up to repossess his merchandise. Now, as we're about to hear what happened during that next 24 hours, a wild plan hatched under a ticking clock brought Danny Paris's business back from the brink. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
This week, stock prices for the radio station operator Clear Channel dropped so low that its tentative buyout is on the verge of collapse. Last week, it was the financial firm Bear Stearns on the chopping block, being bought for pennies on the dollar by J.P. Morgan. Housing prices are down, foreclosures are up, and credit crunch is the buzz phrase all over front pages. Now, that financial term, credit crunch, gets thrown around a lot, and while it seems like an abstract cloud that hovers exclusively around the skyscrapers of Wall Street, Danny Paris knows firsthand that a credit crunch can get very real and very personal. In Michigan, during the late 60s, Danny and his wife already had four kids, with twins on the way. Danny's day job wasn't enough to make ends meet, so he went to a local electronics shop to see if he could earn some extra money. But the only open position was on the sales floor. Now, that was the last thing Danny wanted. He was incredibly shy, but the money in sales was good, so he took the job.
The first customer that I waited on walked in, and he said, "I'd like to see that radio that's in the paper." And I physically could not move, and I just stared at him, and he said, "It's that one right behind you." And I turned around. There was a white RCA radio, a little one there, and said 1188. And I picked it off the counter, and I sat it down, and he said, "How many tubes does it have?" I still didn't open my mouth, and he turned it upside down. The schematic was there, and he said, "Oh, it's got five tubes, so I'll take it." And about an hour later, another customer came in, a lady this time, and she said, "I'd like to see the radio that's in the paper." And I said, "Yes, ma'am, right here it is. It's an RCA. It's a very good radio." She says, "Is it really?" I says, "Oh, yeah, it's got five tubes."
And, and as a matter of fact, I've already sold one today.
Yeah, right. And she said, "I'll take it." And that was my first day, and my wife picked me up that day. We only had one car, and I got in the car, and she said, "How did you do?" And I said, "Well, I sold two radios," and she just yelled, "I knew you could do it. I knew you could do it." And I thought, oh my gosh, if you'd have seen how bad I was, you wouldn't talk like that.
Inauspicious beginnings, perhaps, but Danny got good at selling, really good. After setting sales records at the company he was working for, Danny decided in 1970 that it was time to go out on his own. He opened up an appliance shop, selling a line of Maytag merchandise. But less than a year later, Maytag manufacturers went on strike, and Danny found himself with an empty showroom, two employees that needed paychecks, and only $271 in the bank.
And it was Thursday night. My payroll was due the next day. I thought, well, it's going to be over. And it was 10 to 6. I closed at 6 o'clock, and a car pulled into the front of the store. Didn't even come in. He said, "Is this an appliance store?" And I said, "Yes, sir, it is. And I know what you're thinking. The Maytag company is on strike, but I'm going to get the first truck." And he said, "Well, then we'll just come back." And I said, "Well, you know what? Why don't I just talk to you about them? I've got books here. I can show you pictures." So I made this presentation, and his wife said, "Well, that's the one I want, then we might as well place the order." So they did buy it, and I sat down, and I said, "Well, and how much did you want to put down on it, sir?" And he said, "Well, we'll give you a check for $50. And his wife said, "Would you just write a check for the whole amount? Then I don't have to worry about it. Just pay for the two." And I just held my breath. And he said, "Okay," and he wrote the check, and it came to $624 total. And I made my payroll, and then the truck did land, and you know, the fact that she had that faith in me, I guess it just inspired me. I just said, okay, we're going to make it.
After making that last-minute payroll by the skin of his teeth, Danny Paris saw his business grow from there. He expanded throughout the 70s, and riding a wave of success, he applied for a loan to expand even more. That's when the bank asked him for a routine statement of information on his finances.
So I had my accountant do a personal financial statement, and lo and behold, it comes up I'm a millionaire. I had no idea that I was worth $1 million. And I said, well, holy cow, I'm a millionaire. And I probably believed that anything I did was going to work out because I had such success. And I probably did things. We bought a beautiful, beautiful home. We had 19 acres of lawn. We had an indoor pool. We had a lot of nice things. And that was when the economy changed, and it changed horribly for us. 1980 through basically all the way up to 83 was just a very, very difficult time. The prime rate was 12%. Unemployment was staggering across the country. And here I was all of a sudden now with two big, big stores. I ended up with $1.3 million in inventory. And my cash flow had dropped so precipitously that I was in a bad situation.
And you were out on a limb financially.
I was really out on a limb, yeah.
I'm Aaron Henkin. This is The Story. The creditor that had loaned Danny all that money for his merchandise was General Electric, GE, and they also couldn't help but notice that he was in trouble. They demanded that he put up his house, as well as his business buildings, as collateral. It was risky, but Danny stuck to his guns, and he put up the collateral. He had actually started to turn things around and get his debt down a bit during the following months. It looked like the worst was over, until one day when he sent his warehouse manager to pick up an extra washer and dryer over at a nearby distribution warehouse in Detroit.
The owner's son was there, and he said, how's business? And Bill King, my warehouse manager, said, not bad, it's picking up. And he said, well, you see those two trucks over there? It was two big semis. He said, they're going to be at your store tomorrow. GE's closing you up. And obviously Bill was shocked by that. And he called me and he told me what happened, and I couldn't believe it. I just stood there by the phone. I probably stood there for a few minutes before I got my senses, and I looked at my watch, and it was 10 to 6. And I thought, oh, my gosh, they're even closed. I can't even talk to anybody. But then I realized, no, they're in Chicago. It's 10 to 5 in Chicago. So I called Chicago. I asked for Dan Hardy, who was the head of the division there. I said, Dan, give me one day. I said, just one day to talk to you because I'm going to have this thing taken care of and you'll be off the hook. He said, how are you going to do that? And I said, I'll be there in the morning and I'll explain how this is going to be done. But you don't need to send those trucks. You don't need to take my merchandise and take my building. And he said, well, okay, Danny, but be here at 8 o'clock and we'll talk. And at that point, I didn't know what I was going to say to him. At first I thought, well, I'll just tell him I'm a nice guy and I've got 8 kids and how can you do this? That was my first reaction. I thought that's the only thing I've got to go with. I couldn't believe it. I had worked so hard. When I got home, I told my wife, I told Joyce what was going to happen. And I just said, well, and I'd started to come up with my plan. So I got up at 3 o'clock, got in the car the next morning, and I started to drive because I knew I had to be there on time. If I would have walked in at 10 o'clock, it would have been over with.
You said you had already come up with a plan. What was the plan?
My plan was that I had to talk another company into buying out General Electric's position. They would have to come up with close to $1 million to pay off General Electric. I knew that I had to convince somebody to do it. There was no doubt in my mind.
So you're deep in debt to one creditor, GE.
Mm-hmm.
Your plan is to shift the debt away from GE to somebody else who is going to take on this debt and let you carry on a little longer in trust that you will get back on your feet again.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So did you have any idea whatsoever who you were going to ask to borrow $1 million from?
Well, there was a young man by the name of Bo Massini. He had come to my store several times. He was a representative of ITT.
And ITT is another credit agent.
Another financial lender. But anyway, when I got to this, this meeting in Chicago, and I walked into this building and introduced myself, and they walked me into a big conference room, and I had never been in a conference room like that. The table was, it seemed like it was 90 feet long, but I'm sure it was at least 20 feet long, and there were three chandeliers all along. It went over the center and one at each end, and fancy chairs, beautiful wooden table, nice pictures on the wall. And I just sat there, and they let me wait for them for about 20 minutes, and I was all by myself with all my thoughts.
Like a worm on a hook.
That's the way I felt, too. I just felt like I've come to beg. And then they walked in. There was at least seven or eight guys, and I could tell that there was a lot of hostility. I wasn't treated well, but they let me tell my story. I said, ITT is very serious about taking over your position. They're going to buy you out. And I said, and you can call Bo Massini, and I gave him his number. I said, but you can't call him today because he's doing a marine inventory. I didn't know where he was. I hadn't even talked to Bo yet. And I says, he's not in his office, but he'll be there tomorrow, and you can talk to him. A couple guys said, there's no way on earth they're going to buy us out. I said, well, what does it hurt to wait one day and find out?
What was it like for you to tell that lie? I mean, did you believe it yourself?
I actually believed that I could do it. I thought if there's any chance that I can pull one off, this is the one I can pull off. I only had that one chance, so I knew that I was going to have to give it my best shot. I just had to come up with something, or else I was done for.
The GE executives decided they would give Danny another day. He'd made it over one hurdle, but he'd created a new one. Now he had to show up at the office of a casual acquaintance and convince him to lend him $1 million on the spot. More in a moment. I'm Aaron Henkin from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The economic headlines are grim these days, but they're nothing new. A generation ago, small business owner Danny Paris was wringing his hands. He was $1 million in debt. Truckers were ready to show up at his appliance store to repossess his merchandise and padlock his doors. But Danny had just bought himself another 24 hours. He'd sat in front of a conference room full of his skeptical creditors at General Electric in Chicago and convinced them that he had another lender lined up, ready to take over their loan. This savior's name was Bo Massini, a man at a company called ITT. But there was just one problem, and Danny neglected to mention this at his meeting. Bo Massini had no idea about any of this. Danny walked out of that GE building in Chicago, and before he got in his car to race back to Michigan, he made a desperate call to Bo.
He was at his office, breathed a sigh of relief right then, and I told him, I said, Bo, you're going to get a call tomorrow from General Electric, and all I want you to do is say this. Say, yes, we're talking to Danny Paris. We think that we're interested in doing exactly what he's described to you. We'd like for you to give us some time to go out there and look at the inventory and look at his books. So just hold off, and that's what I want you to tell him.
Now, Danny, it doesn't sound like you really explained to Bo what you had told them at GE. He didn't know anything.
Oh, he said, well, is that all you want me to say, Danny, is tell General Electric? Like I said, you have nothing to lose, Bo, nothing. Just say that for me. And he said that. So Dan Hardy called me and he said...
Dan Hardy is the creditor from GE.
Yeah, yeah. He was from General Electric and he just said, well, okay, we're going to delay this until we get more concrete information from ITT. So in my call to Bo, I also told him, I said, now you've got to set up a meeting with Dennis Robertson. And he was the zone manager for ITT.
Bo's boss.
Yeah,
at ITT.
And he's the decision maker.
So how did that meeting go?
Well, Dennis was a big, robust guy, and I sat in front of him, and I told him the truth. I told him everything that was happening to me. And he just looked at me, and he said, Danny, I don't know if we can do this. And I said, well, just come out to my store, Dennis. Just come out, walk around it, and see what kind of operation I run. So he said, okay, I'll do it. I'll be there Thursday or Friday or whatever day. And he came out, and we sat in my office, and we talked and talked and talked. And eventually they got all my papers and looked at my inventory. And then the next meeting we had, he said, okay, we're going to do it. We're going to take out GE. I just looked at him, and I said, okay, I suppose you'll want me to put up my house and the building as collateral for it. And he said, no, we don't need that. He said, you have enough pressure on you. You don't have to worry about your house, your home, and your business, your building, rather. He said, we're just going to take you at your word. And I was just amazed.
What do you think convinced them?
I don't know. I really don't know. I've tried to think about that several times. Why did he do that? He really put himself at risk. He could have made a mess for himself if I would have defaulted.
What do you think it was about you, Danny, that made him feel like he could trust you? You say you wanted him to come and see your store. Why did you want him to see your store? And, I mean, you were totally honest with him about everything that was going on.
It looked like something worth saving, I think. My family was in there. All my kids worked in the store at one time or another.
You were about as far out there in the wind financially as a small business person could possibly get. Right there on the cliff. Do you think it was luck or faith or good salesmanship?
I don't know. I have a lot of faith. I have an absolutely dedicated wife. She is just amazing. She never doubts anything. She just says, it doesn't matter, Danny. You'll do it. You'll pull it out.
Do you ever think about that alternate future that could have been in store for you if you didn't get word from that person at the warehouse that these trucks were coming with the padlocks?
I couldn't see it. I knew it was just devastation. And, you know, you really can't picture it happening. You don't know that it could happen to me, first of all. I just never knew that things could get that wicked in my life. But, you know, things work out for some reason. And I have that ability or that trait in me, I guess, that says you just don't quit.
You could have had a life of working as an employee at somebody else's appliance store. Instead, you chose this path with its extreme highs and extreme lows. And I wonder how you think your life is different because you chose that path.
I think I'm more humble now. I appreciate effort. I don't think I'm a better or a worse person as a result of this. I don't know that that's the case. I have a lot of respect for people who do achieve things and stay on course.
Did GE ever find out that the promise that you had made to them in that boardroom that morning was, at that point, smoke and mirrors?
No. No, they never knew. Certainly, I wasn't going to tell them. Sometimes I wanted to go back and just tell them, you know what? I never had that in the first place, but you didn't know it. So I never really did that. But there was one guy that was particularly annoying in that meeting, and I always thought I'd like to see him again sometime. But anyway, no, they did not know anything about it. They thought it was all legitimate.
Maybe he'll hear you on the radio.
Yeah.
Danny Paris successfully sold his business in the early 1990s, just as our country's next economic slump was approaching, to minimize his risk. And in case you're wondering, Danny no longer has any debt hanging over his head. He currently works at an auto dealership. It's actually the largest Hummer dealership in the world, and it's just outside of Detroit, coincidentally one of the country's most distressed economic areas. Now that's a testament to salesmanship. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. From the economy, we're going to move now to the environment. Dick recently spoke with an architect by the name of Bill McDonough, whose interest in global connectedness and smarter design has taken him far beyond buildings. Recently, McDonough has been designing entire cities in China. He talked with Dick about how the process works on his design team. They begin by planning out water and street systems that'll be more cooperative with the natural environment.
And then we imagined a whole city covered with farms. We do a lot of green roof buildings.
Yeah.
So we imagined all the buildings in the city having green roofs that were actually gardens. So everybody could go up to the roof and grow vegetables. So you'd end up with the city from the air being all green with people.
You wouldn't even see it as a city.
You wouldn't even see it as a city. And it would be higher, it would have higher biodiversity than farming because you'd have more diverse cropping. The site that we were given is covered with sugarcane. So it's one type of plant covering, you know, hundreds and hundreds of acres of territory.
But what if my house had sugarcane on the roof and I spent all my time at the radio station and I didn't have time to tend my roof?
These are apartment buildings and things like that.
So someone would be in charge of
the
roof?
Sure. Everybody in the building would be offered access to the roof. You know, you could buy a piece of the roof for your own little vegetable garden. But it's just a speculative, you know, concept. My job is to imagine the world in an exquisite way in order to try and approach the practically impossible. So the practical matters of this come after the conceptual.
I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Bill McDonough has been thinking in that exquisite way about how the world could be since he was a child living overseas. His dad was a businessman. Bill did a lot of his growing up in Hong Kong. But he says Tokyo, the place where he was born, is where he learned his most important lessons about society, resources, and natural cycles.
At 2 o'clock in the morning, we would wake up to hear ox carts rumbling through the city. And they were coming with carts to collect our sewage. And my mother used to refer to them as the honey wagons coming to collect the night soil.
And these were buckets that were set outside, or how was that done?
Oh, I don't remember the details of how the material was transferred.
It's a name, though, that lives on. When I lived in the Canadian Arctic,
the honey bucket.
The honey wagon would come and pump people's septic tanks out.
Yeah, take septic tanks. But I remember that she would call them that. And I remember that we'd also hear ox carts come in the morning bringing tofu and vegetables through the city. So at night, out went the waste, and in the morning, in came the food. So this whole connection between waste and food was something that seemed very natural as a child.
Any idea, looking back on it now, if the waste that was being taken out was in any way being used as a form of mulch or recycling to grow that food?
That was definitely the story. I mean, everybody knew that. That's what was happening. The whole idea that your sewage became food was just not unusual. It was just common, ordinary, everyday good sense. And then when we moved to Hong Kong was a crowded place with very limited resources. We had 4 hours of water every fourth day during the dry season.
4 hours of water every fourth day.
Every fourth day.
What, you filled up tanks on the roof of the apartment building?
Filled up your bathtub.
Right.
And you just adapted to it. It was the way it was.
It didn't make your life particularly difficult or awkward.
No. I mean, you had to stand in line to collect water at the tap like other people. But that was it.
And your dad was a business executive. You were living well, and yet you lived with these conditions. So I guess it was tougher on the people who lived in the lower class parts
and
of
Hong Kong,
right?
The squatter villages and the hillsides and things like that, of course. You know, you would see people standing in line waiting at the taps with their Klim cans, we call them. There used to be a powdered milk called Klim, which was milk spelled backward, which was very famous in the developing countries.
It actually had a handle on it.
It had a handle on it.
A little pail, right?
Yeah. It was a square bucket that was full of powdered milk, and then it would be used as a bucket for water. And people would have them on sticks over their shoulders and be standing waiting for water. We didn't have to go through all that, but we got to see that every day. But you also saw people taking whatever protein they could find. You would see people standing beneath streetlights with long bamboo wands, knocking the beetles out of the air so that they could cook them.
Seriously?
And eat them, yeah. So at night, you would see all the bugs flying around the street lamps, and there would be somebody who essentially owned that space. That was their livelihood, was selling cooked beetles underneath that street lamp at night.
During his conversation with Dick Gordon, Bill McDonough remembered those images of relative scarcity alongside memories of lushness and plenty on the other side of the world. His parents had family in the Hood Canal region of Washington's Puget Sound. When Bill spoke with Dick, he talked about the vacations he'd spend there as a kid.
it was a bit of paradise for me because my grandparents lived in a log cabin on a on salt water and raised oysters, big oyster beds out in front for their own consumption, and put them away for the winter. And we used to have oyster roasts all the time on the beach. But they lived in old-growth Douglas fir forest. And whereas in Hong Kong, we lived in a world of extreme limits, and everybody was really careful with every bit. My grandparents lived in a world of abundance. I remember my favorite thing about the place was the creek that ran behind the house that you could drink out of. And the idea that you could actually just go and put your face in a stream and drink was amazing to me, because in Hong Kong, that would have never have happened.
Did you see it as a contrast at the time, a contrast between scarcity on one hand and abundance on the other?
No, I think that all really came later.
Yeah.
All this is on in retrospect. It was just the way it was. I mean, when you're a little kid, just the world is the way it is. So I went from one place that was like this to another place that was like that. Later, when we moved to Connecticut when I was a young teenager, and the thing that astonished me was seeing boys leaving the showers running on hot water in the gym locker room after gym and just leave the showers running and go out and towel off and get dressed and go about their day with all the showers still running with hot water in the shower room. I just left there running, and I would run around and turn them all off. And I just never understood how anybody could leave water running to begin with. And then the energy use, having hot water was an additional burden.
Was this just like a rote reaction on your
part?
Yeah,
it was a rote reaction, a very visceral one.
Yeah.
So I remember that really shocked me, this conspicuous consumption that we had in our culture that I didn't really think about very much until then.
I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. When Bill McDonough went off to college, he studied photography. Along the way, he met a famous photographer, Walker Evans, well known for his portraits of Americans during the Great Depression. The first time Bill met Walker Evans, the elderly photographer was ailing in a hospital room. Bill had brought along one of his own photos, but he was so nervous, he left it in the hallway.
And all I did was go in and say, "Mr. Evans, I'm here to pay my respects to you. I'm so glad you're here. I'm sorry you won't be able to, work with us out there because you're in the hospital." And he just sort of looked at me and said, "Well, if you're a photographer, where's a photograph? You're coming to see me without a photograph?" So I went out and got the picture, and I brought it in, and he stared at it for about 20 minutes.
What was it of?
Of a door. The door with a screen door in front of it on an old house in New Hampshire. And he stared at it for 20 minutes, and then he looked up at me and he said, "This isn't great, but it's very close. You have to come bring me a picture every night." And so for night after night, I would bring him a picture, one picture a night, and he would just look at it and then talk to me about it.
Did he tell you what he'd seen in that photograph?
Sure. Yeah. He said, "Anyone can get the light reflected off a surface. The hard part is to get the light that's in the air." And when he said that, he didn't just mean something technical like use this kind of developer and get soft focus, or he didn't mean that literally. He meant, I think, the time that it was taken, both in terms of its physical time, the light was sharp or not sharp, depending on time of day, but also the time in the culture. When you look at his pictures, from the Farm Security Administration,
he was in many ways like the cataloger of the Depression.
Of the Depression, yeah.
Where was he, in Alabama when he was taking
Alabama,
those
the famous photographs.
Yeah.
But he was down in Louisiana and Mississippi. He photographed erosion in Mississippi. Amazing set of photographs. Just soil erosion. So just pictures of the dirt being washed away. When he said that, light in the air, it really meant the zeitgeist, the time, the time of culture.
So what little piece of Walker Evans still lives in Bill McDonough, the architect? Where's his inspiration in the work that you do today?
Well, I try to find the light that's in the air. I try to find out what it is about our time that makes it special, and what is the work to do in that special time. And if you look at our time, the light that's in the air is that we have climate change on our hands. We have global warming. We have persistent toxification. We have endocrine disruption. We have heavy metal contamination. We have persistent toxins. We have loss of culture, the destruction of community. We have, you know, energy waste, wrong energy use, nuclear waste, plastics in the oceans. We have all sort of litany of tragedies that are of our own making as a species. That's the light that's in the air.
Bill McDonough has become one of the world's most prominent pioneers of green design. We'll hear about some of his unusual ideas, recyclable sneakers, and a cab service driven by grandmothers in a moment. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. From American Public Media, this is The Story. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Bill McDonough is known around the world for his green design. He's worked with big corporations like Ford and Gap and Nike. He did the roof garden for Chicago's City Hall. When Bill talked with Dick, he explained that a lot of the energy behind his creative thinking has come from a particular friendship. Bill discovered a special intellectual kinship with a chemist and industrial designer named Michael Braungart. They met in New York.
I had heard that he was going to be in New York, and I went to see him. He was opening an office there, and I got there early, and he and I started talking, and he sat through the entire opening of his office with all these dignitaries coming to visit, with just talking to me, and we just kept talking into the night, and I must have talked till 2 in the morning, till they shut the place down.
Famous people came by, and the whole German community came by, and the United Nations people, and I said, just hello, nice to see you, but I forgot that I was the host, yeah, because I was talking to Bill until the middle of the night. We talked about how we could reinvent everything around us, yeah, how we could make things, instead of being left bad, in making them good. And then we said how it could be that everybody really enjoys, celebrates abundance, instead of minimizing being bad.
We were talking about everything under the sun. We were talking about taxi cabs and water bottles and shoes and buildings and the making of things. We talked about the making of things and how they could be different. And in my life, I would say meeting Michael was the big moment in my life in terms of bringing it all together, because he presented a view of the world as a chemist that I hadn't really ever had access to, not being a scientist. And
so what was the missing part for the two of you? Here's the German chemist and the American architect. What did you give to each other that somehow
clicked?
Well,
he gave me chemistry and I gave him design. And so when we created a company, we called it Design Chemistry.
Bill is definitely my best friend. Yeah, he's generous, he's friendly, he is funny, and you can play with ideas and thoughts.
A taxi really represents the automobile as a service. That
okay.
It provides you the service. When you need the mobility, you get the mobility at your behest. And that really you didn't need to own a car in New York. There were taxis that could take you around. So we started to imagine what would it be like if the elders in communities managed the mobility system and took the kids to their soccer games and ballet lessons and whatever, and brought the generations back together so that the elders were driving the kids around. Because we're going to have an older population that's very capable of doing all sorts of things and want to be part of society. And yet in modern culture, we take the elders and put them in file cabinets and deny the kids mobility, so the middle-aged people are running around driving the kids around all the time.
This is neither architecture nor chemistry.
This
is a kind of social philosophy that you guys are talking about.
Right. But then what happens is then you could talk about the automobile as a different kind of thing. You could see it as a service, which meant that it could be made differently. You could make it out of materials that go back to cars or back to soil. They could be glued together and come apart with enzyme keys that, you know, allow them to disassemble automatically, things like that. So we got into all sorts of really crazy, marvelous speculations about the making of things.
When Bill McDonough looks around him at how we currently live our daily lives here in the U.S., he has plenty to speculate about. In many ways, he explained to Dick Gordon, we're all living far in the past.
If you look at the houses that were built in 1969, and you look at the houses that are being built today, the houses today, generally in the United States, let's say, might have more energy-efficient windows or something like that. But they're still oriented strangely. You know, they'll put down on subdivision plots facing every which direction.
Everything is paved around them.
Everything is paved. Everything is scraped first, and then a few trees get planted back. It's really the same design. It's tuned up a little bit, but it's the same stuff. And so I think, you know, once I started working with solar energy and buildings, you realize that our grandparents and great-grandparents and indigenous architectures all were incredibly sensitive to climate because they had to be. They didn't have cheap fossil fuels. They had to go out and cut the wood to burn it to get warm. So you really paid attention to where you put your window and where the sun was.
And how you insulated your walls.
And as best you could. You know, and they just did as well as they could given all the natural phenomenon that were going on around them. So modern design hasn't really changed to reflect that new consciousness that we're on one planet.
I asked Bill to give me a practical example of where we could see that change. So we started talking about this dark brown industrial piece of carpet that's here on the floor of my studio.
For this radio station floor, you know, what you want is acoustics. You want comfort. You want appearance. You want cleanability, things like that.
Right.
What you have here is an asset, but it's also a liability in the sense that when you want to get rid of this carpet, you're going to have to pay to have it removed because its materials are not designed to go into a second life. It's really designed to become waste. And so if we eliminate the concept of waste, then what you want is the surface of the carpet while you're using it. But then when you finish with it, wouldn't it be marvelous if it could become a carpet again? So what we've done with Shaw is developed a carpet where the top is a nylon 6 caprolactam-based polymer, so it's plastic.
Okay. It's comfy if you're walking around in bare
feet. Just like yours, just like this one right here, just like this. It doesn't have any different characteristics. And the underlayment is a thermoplastic polyolefin, another plastic that's transformed by heating and cooling it. And so the carpet is hard on the bottom, it's rubbery, and then fibers on the top, just like this carpet. But when you finish with it, you call Shaw up and say, I'm finished with the carpet, I'd like a new one, please. And they come and take the old one away because it's the raw material of the new carpets. The carpet can be shredded, and the top, which is very light, goes up. The bottom, which is heavy, goes down. They can separate the caprolactam from the polyolefin, and then they chemically recycle the caprolactam, and they thermoplastically reform the underlayment and make new carpet out of it.
But why would I do that? Wouldn't I be just as inclined to say to the guy who's coming in to redo my studio, I just take all that stuff and throw it in the landfill because it's where everything goes, the old sheetrock and the carpet on the fabric on the walls and stuff like that. It'll all go to the landfill because that's where it's always gone. What's the incentive to do it a different way?
Well, that's the marvelous thing about the economy. See, we can, to you, who's throwing it away, it's a cost because you have to pay to have it taken to a landfill. Under our protocol, the company that makes the carpet wants it back.
And will pay me for it?
Sure. And what they see, the real value to them is that they get their customer back. That's the big value to them. If you think about just, you know, we work with companies like Nike or Ford or whatever, you know, in the product space. An easier example would be a sneaker. If you designed a sneaker to go back to become sneakers again, what incentive does somebody have to take an old pair of sneakers back to the store?
$10
on the new pair of sneakers. Yeah. Right, exactly. Now, you stop and think about it. The sneaker companies, 70% of their budgets are for marketing. So the real value is to get the customer back. So it's the same with the carpet company. See, if you
So you're saying that there's still an incentive to return the shoe, even if it's just money that keeps me as a Reebok or a Nike customer.
Sure.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, because you become part of the family. You're part of the story. The shoe becomes part of the story.
Okay, so they're willing to pay me $10 to take my old sneakers back to the store, but what's going to happen to them at that point? Are they then going to...
Well,
at
Nike, they have a program called Reuse a Shoe,
yeah,
where they grind them up and use them for athletic surfaces. But in the long term, I mean, our cradle-to-cradle idea essentially says that the materials are all designed to either go back to soil safely and be biodegradable and rebuild our soils, or go back to industry forever.
So the grinding up of the sneaker's not quite,
it's not quite there
at
yet.
The level that you want, right?
No,
this
not.
Is where you've said, and I've read it before, you say that if someone were to take a bunch of old plastic bags from the grocery store and turn those into a park bench, right. That's not good enough for you.
That's
but I thought that was okay.
That's down what we call downcycling. It's great to have recycling. The part of the issue, though, is that today a lot of things are actually downcycled, not recycled. So if I take milk jugs or plastic bottles that are clear, and they end up becoming some homogenized dark plastic on its way to a landfill, stopping off as a park bench or speed bump or something like that. It's still losing quality, and it's still on its way to a landfill or incinerator. What we call recycling is when something is actually recycled, where it becomes itself again or something like it at the same level of quality. And then we also characterize something we would call upcycled, as something that's improving itself as it goes through the recycling process, like water bottles that right now have antimony, which is a heavy metal, as a residue of a catalytic reaction. And that antimony can be removed during the recycling. So you actually improve the product's quality while it's recycled. That would be upcycling.
I read the other day about a new plastic bag that BASF has devised, which is completely biodegradable.
Mm-hmm.
Which didn't really work for me because it sort of had that idea that I could, you know, carry my groceries home and then just throw it out the kitchen window and eventually it would return to the earth. I don't think that's really what you're talking about either, is it?
Well, it could be. I mean, when you think about things that could go back to soil, think about the pen that you might have in your hand.
Yeah.
Well, it's plastic, it's metal, it's inks, it's a combination of things. When you finish with that pen, you'll throw it in the garbage. And it'll get landfilled probably.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
Now, what if that pen was made out of materials that could biodegrade, all of them, including the inks safely without heavy metals? The cartridge could be biodegradable plastic. The body of the pen could be biodegradable plastic. And they could add a little nitrogen in it as a kicker just for the fun of it and make it into a fertilizer spike so that when you finish with the pen, instead of throwing it away...
Stick it in a flower pot.
Stick it in your local flower pot.
Are we there? Are we anywhere close to that? Or are you talking about, you know, what might be in the future?
I think we're really on the brink of this.
I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Story. A bit earlier during this conversation between Dick and Bill McDonough, the architect was explaining that he's currently offering plans to the Chinese to restore farmland by putting it up on the rooftops of buildings in cities. Now, if the Chinese decide they're willing to try it, Bill is convinced it'll work. He sees lots of examples where smarter design has already started to clean up places that were once horribly polluted.
I remember one of our first projects in this country related to cities was Chattanooga, as they were developing their eco-city concept. And they told stories about how in 1969 they were declared the worst air quality in America because they have these mountains around them and they have a big inversion.
Right.
And a lot of foundries that were burning coal and things like that. Anyway, you had to wear, you know, two shirts during the day because your collars would turn black. You had to drive around at noon with headlights at noon. Amazing. And so just fast forward to Beijing, and there it is. In Beijing, you can taste the air. You can taste the coal. It's absolutely unbelievable.
Do you see in Chattanooga today what Beijing could be?
Yeah.
20 years from now?
Yeah.
And are you encouraged by that?
I'm encouraged by that, except that I'm terrified at what the Chinese are about to go through. Just the time it'll take and the scale of the transformation that's required. Because in Chattanooga, what they did is they shut down the foundries. And the question is, where did they go? Well,
to China.
To China. So where do they go from China? I don't know. So it's a real serious question. You know, China and India are both raging economies now. And, you know, I don't know where it goes from there unless it ends up, you know, going to even more marginal places. But I can't see it. I think it'll end up in China, stay in China.
Bill, if it's your I was going to say your job, but it's something, it's bigger than a job. If it's your place here to think in terms of exquisite design and ideally how things could be, do you spend a lot of time kind of shaking your head, despairing over the fact that in such logical places where there ought to be public transit, there is not? In places where there ought to be sensible buildings, there are not?
I'd say I spend half my time trying to imagine what 100% good looks like, and the other half of my time just trying to get from day to day, just like everybody else. But I have the privilege of being able to live in a design world, so I get to imagine the future. It's a privileged activity. I personally get to focus on telescopic images of what's possible way out in the future. And then I deal with things on a daily basis as best I can. My job is to identify, articulate, and then render visible ideas that we can perform on. So when we did the Ford factory with one of the world's largest green roofs.
How big was that roof?
It's 10.5 acres.
How many football fields is that? Can you help me?
Oh,
10.5 acres.
How many football fields is that? Two or maybe two football fields, something like that. We couldn't do everything in that building, but we could hold on to that one idea that the stormwater management on that site was so critical and so expensive to do conventionally, somewhere between $18 and $48 million, depending on how you interpret the Clean Water Act. And our system cost $13 million. So we saved Ford anywhere from $5 to $35 million using a green roof. That's the kind of economics that, you know, can allow these projects to inspire other people.
Let me ask you just one more question about China. Do you ever smile at the idea, the notion that you did so much of your growing up in Hong Kong, which is now a part of China, you know, wandering around the streets of that city in short pants, looking up at the way the world was unfolding at that time, and that now as a one of the world's leading green architects, you're back in China helping them redesign the country.
Yeah, it's daunting and humbling because it's so hard and the need is so dire.
Bill McDonough is an architect and designer who's written extensively about the kinds of changes that can be made, that we can make, to live a healthier life. If you'd like to read more about Bill McDonough and his work, we have links at our website, thestory.org. Now, maybe you've had a moment of inspiration when a light bulb went on in your head, a compact fluorescent light bulb, perhaps, and a new, more environmentally friendly way of living life has occurred to you. If you have a story of your own about how you're working to help clean up the planet and use our resources more wisely, get in touch. Here's our website again, thestory.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Story, 50-something divorcee Linda Kelso decided to put up a personal profile on an internet dating site, and she cast a pretty wide net.
I like complexity, mystery, intrigue, caves, buildings, water, fabric, forests, art, engineers, students, scientists, cooks, carpenters. What I want out of life, tranquility, a chance to create art, a warm place to sleep, someone to talk to.
What she wasn't looking for was a scammer out to take her for her money. But that's what Linda got. Tomorrow, vulnerability and deceit in cyberspace. Thanks for being with us this hour. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, our email address again, thestory.org. You can also give us a call and leave a message at 1-888-966-9862. That number again, 1-888-966-9862. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Dick Gordon. From American Public Media, this is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.